right, we're having our Sabbath Bible study today, and it'll be for us the fifth month and the 22nd day of the month, 2017. And if you would like to hear the prior studies to this, go to renewedcovenantministry.com. It's all one word, and look for the Sabbath Bible studies that can be found on the webpage up top. And you'll be able to get some of the background as we are going to be discussing the book of Ruth today, which I found surprising that I got pretty excited in studying it. And we're going to try to cover the first chapter, which I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to do. But there's a lot of information that's going to get packed into this besides just the first chapter of Ruth. The first thing I want to mention is something that I don't think a lot of people realize about Ruth, but Ruth is actually the last four chapters out of the book of Judges. It is not its own book, and it hasn't been its own book historically. It has always been associated with the Judges, and it was actually part of the same scroll. So, a lot of times we ask the question, why is the book of Ruth in the Bible? You know, what is the purpose of it, and what is its reason for this short book about two widowed women making their way back to the land of Israel, and to Bethlehem specifically? Why is it that it is its own book, other than the fact that we know that Ruth was the great-great-grandmother of King David? All right, we know that because the Bible spells it out very clear at the end of the book of Ruth. But there's something a lot more going on in the book of Ruth, and it's kind of amazing, really, as you look at the history behind it and what it is talking about. And if you would follow along in the prior Sabbath Bible study, which came out of Judges, chapter 19 through 21, you'll see that there are places, specifically Mount Ephraim and Bethlehem, that have been mentioned over and over again with the association now of the tribe of Benjamin, which prior, if we would remember, had led a rebellion in favor of deviancy in order to lead their people astray. And there was a war that was caused out of the tribe of Benjamin. So that's actually a very important part of the book of Ruth that most people don't realize, and I'm going to try to go out of my way to show why that's important and put some heavy emphasis on the historical and the spiritual connection that Ruth is supposed to show us. One of the things that I found interesting in trying to find out what the name Ruth means is not only is it a Hebrew word, but the word could be translated a dozen different ways. One way that's commonly believed that her name is referencing is that it's talking about a friend, particularly a female friend. And there's only one place in the Bible where I could find the word used, and it was in Exodus chapter 11, where the Israelites are instructed to borrow from their neighbors and friends and to spoil the Egyptians ultimately. And the friend, the female's friends being referred to is the word Ruth. So that's the only time. So it's not a very commonly used word, but it is a Hebrew word, which the people of Moab spoke a dialect that would be considered close to Hebrew. And I can't say whether or not they would have had some of the similar words or not. However, as we discuss who Ruth is and where she came from and why it is that we're reading about her, all of this is going to, I think, play a role in understanding her purpose in the Israel message, the overall Israel message, to us as we consider it as Christians, particularly Christians after the coming of Christ. So let's go to Ruth chapter 1 and take a look at what it says. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled, that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went and sojourned in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of his two sons was Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab, and they continued there." All right, so we are getting a story once again about one of our key places that has been mentioned over and over again in the book of Judges. And this is Bethlehem, Judah, which we know is a very special place, and we mentioned in our last study, because Bethlehem was the town of David, the city of David, and it was the place of David's birth, but it was also the place of Christ's birth, which it has a symbology then to us and to those people in looking back at Judges, because it's the city of the king. It's the place of the birthplace of the king. And most especially, out of Bethlehem was the Christ supposed to come. So we know that that specific city had a special impact on the people of Israel. And we also know that Mount Ephraim, which we had talked about in the last message as well, Mount Ephraim was the place where Jeroboam came from, who was the king of the 10 tribes of Israel and led Israel astray, the son of Nebat. And so as we keep seeing those places pop up, we can understand that they have very significant roles in Israelite history. We also have this place called Moab that has in the past played a specific role as well. Now, some commonalities, though, that I've been alluding to and talking about, I'd like to point out, and I had pointed out in the last messages, so we can clarify and remember this, is number one, the book of Ruth is not its own. It's the last four chapters of Judges. This is important because of the misconceptions and the ignorant or arrogant suppositions made upon the woman Ruth and her offspring. This is why I'm making such a point about this. That mainly King David and David's Lord, as it is said, my Lord, the Lord said unto my Lord, so we know this is David's Lord talking about Jesus Christ, that if she is the ancestor of Christ, everything we say about her is going to reflect upon our Lord, is going to reflect on the Messiah, and is going to put a light on who he is. Number two, the fact that our subject characters are once again taken from the areas that we have so many times referenced, Bethlehem, Judah, the future home of King David, the capital of the place of Judah before Jerusalem was made the capital. And when David was king, Jerusalem was not taken until further into his reign. So this was kind of the first capital of the united tribes of Israel, we could call it. It's not called that in the Bible, but when all 12 tribes were united together. If we also remember back, Bethlehem's the place which the Levite of the prior chapter took his unfaithful concubine from. The concubine was from Bethlehem, Judah, as Elimelech and his family are from Bethlehem, Judah also. It's also, as well, the original homeland of Jonathan the Levite, who was Michael, the idol worshiper, the one who led the tribe of Dan astray. Jonathan, that priest, Micah, is the one who came from Bethlehem, Judah. So we have these characters that have been carried over into the book of Ruth that I think we're being asked to remember these important roles. And all of these, I think, have a realistic symbology, and that's important to remember. The people of Bethlehem, Judah, point three, the people of Bethlehem, Judah, here mentioned, are said to have gone sojourning, Elimelech's family, in the land of Moab. Now, if it may be recalled in Judges 3:1, here's where we're going to start getting into the history. If it can be recalled in Judges 3:1, which you can go there if you'd like to, I'm going to read a paraphrase of Judges chapter 3. I'm not going to cover every point because we already have that prior. But recall, the children of Israel did evil again in the sight of Yahweh. Yahweh strengthened Eglon, king of Moab, against Israel for 18 years, we're told. 15 goes to say, but when the children of Israel cried to Yahweh, Yahweh raised them up a deliverer, Ehud the son of Gera, a Benjamite, a man left-handed, and by him the children of Israel sent a present unto Eglon, the king of Moab. But Ehud made him a dagger which had two edges, and Eglon was a very fat man, we're told. And Ehud said, I have a message from God unto thee. And he arose out of his seat, and Ehud put forth his left hand and took the dagger from his right thigh and thrust it into his belly. And it came to pass that when he was come, that he blew a trumpet in Mount Ephraim. Now, another important thing to remember, we're talking about all of these connections, Mount Ephraim and Bethlehem. So there's another one of our important places, Mount Ephraim, where this Benjamite named Ehud, son of Gera, blows his trumpet. And the children of Israel went down with him from the mount, and he before them. Here's where, in my opinion, the story starts to get interesting, by examining the scriptural record. If we wish to know why Israelites were sojourning in heathen Moab, the background from Judges chapter 3 is important, from Judges chapter 3 is important in understanding Judges 21 war, which had just happened with Benjamin. Now remember, Benjamin was a people who had gone after other gods by serving them, a service which included homosexuality and rape, which is, you know, it's one of the most appalling things so far, I think, in the book of Judges, which was the cause of the war. That's why the war started, according to Deuteronomy chapter 13. The concubine was raped to death. She was from Bethlehem, the city of David. The enemy from Benjamin was an Israelite people just as well. In our next chapter, and in the story which we call Ruth, so when I say the next chapter, I mean Ruth chapter 1, the Bethlehemites are fleeing a famine, and they're going to Moab. In chapter 3 of Judges, Moab was the oppressor, and Benjamin was the deliverer of Israel through Ehud, son of Gera, when he blew his trumpet on Mount Ephraim, the home of the prior Levite and Micah the idolater. This is a very interwoven story so far if you go back and just look at the record we already have about the last time we heard anything about the tribe of Benjamin. Okay, he was the deliverer. And he was the deliverer from the oppressor Moab. So why would the people of Judah sojourn in Moab? When I say the people of Judah, I'm referring to the people of Bethlehem. Apparently, Benjamites had a tendency to sojourn there often. Just consider this, 1 Chronicles chapter 8. Okay? And I'm going to once again read a paraphrase out of that, where I've clipped some stuff so I don't have to read the length of the entire section I want to look at. But 1 Chronicles 8, verse 1 says, "Now Benjamin begat Bela, his firstborn, and the sons of Bela were Adar and Gera." And then in 6 it says, "And these are the sons of Ehud." And we just heard that Ehud was the son of Gera, right? "These are the heads of the fathers of the inhabitants of Geba, and they removed themselves to Mahanahath." And then it says, that, now notice it says, "removed themselves to Mahanahath." "And Naaman and Ahiah and Gera he removed, and he begat Uzzah and Ahihud." And let's see if I can say this name right. "Shehariam begat children in the country of Moab. After he had sent them away, Husham and Bera were his wives." So here's what we can collect out of 1 Chronicles 8. That a man we've already just been familiar with from the tribe of Benjamin, the tribe that just in 21 had made war with Israel and had become a wicked people, Ehud's children removed themselves to a place called Mahanahath. Now, that's an interesting place, and we're going to discuss that a little bit, because it's said by most commentaries that Mahanahath is a place in the land of Moab. And as well, we're told in 8:8 that the people removed themselves. He begat children in the land of Moab. And the word "removed themselves" is no different than any other time in the Bible when we read, "And Israel was removed from out of Yahweh's sight." Okay? So we actually see that people from the tribe of Benjamin have been in the land of Moab for quite some time, ever since the time of Ehud and the time of some of his sons. And it also says the heads of the fathers of the inhabitants of Geba removed. They were removed at that time. Okay. So in the time of Ehud, did they go there or not? I'm not sure, but this is something I dug up out of the Hebrew that I thought was kind of interesting, and I want to share. It says, in looking at it, "I can't say why Ehud and his father would have moved some of his family to Mahanahath of Moab, if that is the place, that is. But what I find interesting is that if you look at the word in Judges 3:15 where it says, the word present, referring to the present that was going to be given to the king. We are told that there are those who were bringing presents to the king often. All right. I think that what that's referring to are these heads of the people that removed to this place. All right. And here's why I think that. Because the word present in the King James is derived from the Hebrew mehenahi, which is the male version of mehenahath. The TH at the end feminizes the word, and it's just a different tense. And the place said in 1 Chronicles 8:6, which I just read, it says they were removed to is called Mehenahath. All right. Now, if you want to look at this in the Strong's, you can look at H4503, which is the Mehenahi. And then you can look at H4506, which is Mehenahath. All right. The word is identical in meaning. They mean the same thing, a present or an offering. Okay. And the E is replaced with a TH, is a matter of tense, as I said. But both are suffixes to the word referring to it. So, in other words, the verse could just as well read and be understood. They removed with the present. In other words, when Ehud and his people came to give presents to the king of Moab, that was the time in which the people moved to the land of Moab, to the place of the present. Okay? And I think that that's a very possible interpretation of that verse because of the context surrounding it and how it occurs in 1 Chronicles chapter 8. This is perhaps the time, like I said, when these men left and dwelt in Moab at the time described in Judges 3:18. As the text shows, Israel went to Moab to present a present. Some were, we are told, they did not return to their inheritance, to the land of Benjamin. In any case, Mehenahath is shown either to be a whether it's shown to be a literal place in Moab. Let's say that archaeologists one day find this and prove my supposition entirely wrong. That's fine. I'm not making a doctrine off of it. But if Mehenahath is a literal place in Moab, it still there is a it references the same time frame. So no matter what the interpretation or if it's an actual town and has nothing to do with the present of Ehud, that is the time frame we're given in Chronicles that the Benjamites moved to the land of Moab. So we know that this war that took place in Judges 19 through 21, Benjamites lived in the land of Moab at that time. Okay? And that was the context we entered into the book of Ruth from. We entered into the book of Ruth right after men were looking for wives for Benjamin. They couldn't find wives because they had destroyed all of the land of Benjamin due to their wicked sin. And so it would make perfect sense that we would get into the land of Moab and find Benjamites being talked about. Now, why didn't God decide to inspire the writer to spell this out? I think it's because if they knew it in the book of Chronicles in 8, they already were aware of this situation because of what was said in chapter 3 of Judges. All right, it didn't have to spell it out specifically that when they went there, they went to dwell with the other Israelites who were living or were removed, which is the exact word used. And when I say removed, there's something that needs to be remembered. When a person is removed from out of their inheritance in an Israelite society, we aren't talking about someone who moves can come home and has a place to go. Instead, when someone's removed, they're removed like Israelites are now. We are removed as an Israelite, European Israelite people. In other words, we can't go back to our tribal inheritance in the land of Israel right now because it doesn't exist. We don't have right to prove that is our land inheritance at this specific place. So when we are removed, when Israel is removed into the land of Assyria or removed into the land of Babylon, or any other place in the Bible where Israel is removed, they are actually stripped away from their inheritance. The inheritance is lost. Okay? They are accounted heathen. They are accounted Gentiles. That's why we have the word Gentile. And this is one of the reasons why I think it's very important to consider the Israel message as we consider the book of Ruth, who is, in effect, a symbolism for the lost tribes of Israel. Our friend. Ruth 1:3 says, and Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. Now, it's interesting because Elimelech in Hebrew means God is my king. Okay, that's the literal meaning of his name. And Naomi means pleasant. It's pleasant. So as we look at this from a symbolic point of view, it's good to know the meanings of these people. So we're told that this woman's husband dies, Pleasant, and her husband, who is God is my king, he is dead. And this Pleasant woman is made a widow. And she was left and her two sons, and they took them wives of the women of Moab. Now, this is why I am trying to make a point about where these people come from, because this is what the text says. And if we just take it incredibly literal with no background, no information, we would be led to believe that these women were Moabites. They were descendants of the man named Moab, who, if you remember correctly, was a descendant of Lot, Abraham's nephew, conceived by an incestuous relationship. An incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter, daughters plural, but one specifically who made the man called Moab. All right, and so that is why I am focusing in on this section of explaining who Ruth was and why there would be Benjamites or Israelites in the land of Moab. But we're told in 1:4, it says, they took them wives, referring to Mahlon and Chilion. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. Ruth, I will just say, our friend. And they dwelt there about 10 years. Now, here's the reason why I continuously keep talking about this. Consider this law of Scripture, which at this point, if you know the law of God, and if you don't, it's a good time to learn it, which these men of Judah would have violated, and the repercussions it would have on our biblical testament, on the truth of the Scriptures. Consider this. Deuteronomy chapter 23, verse 3. It says, an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of Yahweh. That could just as well be translated, as it is in the Greek Scriptures, it says the church of the Lord, or the church of God, the congregation of Yahweh. Even to their 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of Yahweh forever. Because they met you not with bread and with water in the way, when ye came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor, of Pethor, of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. Nevertheless, Yahweh thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but Yahweh thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because Yahweh thy God loved thee. Thou shalt not seek their peace, nor their prosperity, all of thy days forever. As well, we see a realistic application of this law. We actually have a record in the Bible of this law and how it's applied. Some have said in the past that this is only referencing men. In other words, males were not allowed to enter into the congregation, but that's a little bit foolish, and the reason I say that is foolish is because men were never part of the congregation of Yahweh. They never would receive land inheritance unless they were born to an Israelite father. Okay, land inheritance in the land of Israel was perpetually belonging to the family and always reverted back to the family in the time of the Jubilee. So in other words, what I'm trying to tell you is that there is no reason for it to mention specifically that men cannot become part of the congregation as a whole. Okay, this is referring to females just as well. And a realistic application of the law can be seen in Ezra 9:1 and Ezra 10:1, or I'm sorry, not 9:1, Ezra 9 through Ezra chapter 10. And the second witness of Nehemiah would be also found in Nehemiah 13, 1 through 3, which I will read a section of just so you can hear it. It says, on that day they read the book of Moses in the audience of the people, and therein it was found written an Ammonite and a Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever. Now it came to pass, it says in verse 3, that when they heard the law, they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude, and that included the women and children as well. So we know Israel was actually involved in mixing with the Moabites during the time of Nehemiah. And because of that, Nehemiah and Ezra had to lead the people in repentance of this type of mixture. All right, so we know this applies to females. So if Ruth were a Moabite descended from the people of Moab, we would have a problem with this being the ancestor of King David and ultimately the ancestor of Christ. So something to greatly consider whenever we hear what some suppose, contrary to the sovereignty and law of God, this law was not relaxed in the days of Ruth. It's not like they just decided to ignore it at this time and it didn't matter anymore. But you will hear multiple people in modern commentaries who are trying to promote the idea of universalism through the book of Ruth and the idea of race mixing and all kinds of universal ideas based upon this idea. And what is so damaging to our understanding of the scripture of this is if God will break his law and even make his Christ contrary to his own law, then we have full ability to break God's law ourselves. We have no need to listen to the rules and laws of God after that. God will relax the law as he sees fit, and men will operate upon it. And then we ourselves will start to do the same. So it really does undermine the entirety of God's sovereignty, and that should be considered whenever we consider how some commentaries view this text. You won't have to go far to find somebody who will say that. I'm not going to waste any time reading that right now from somebody else just so you can hear it, but it is definitely a common view in our world today. Rather, the context of the book of Judges, which Ruth is, as I keep saying, and I'm saying it a bunch because I want to drill it in, the last four chapters of the book of Judges. It is a historical record that shows in the book, and I showed out of 1 Chronicles chapter 8 and provided much evidence for a more holistic story than the scholars and so-called seminarians who love to fondly oppose themselves and negate their own faith by asserting that Deuteronomy chapter 23 verse 3 is ignored by Elimelech, Mahlon, and Chilion, and who are the ancestors of King David and our perfect Christ. This would ultimately render Yahweh's congregation to have been polluted, his church, his ecclesia, forever. As the text says, it shall be forever. That's something that we should not take lightly. It's a big problem. So don't let it go unnoticed by pushing this law aside and accepting a universal doctrine, as some theologians insist. And we have to remember, we are warned about heeding to our fleshly mind, which is constantly at enmity with Yahweh's perfect righteousness and his perfect law. Okay, so that's something that is very, very important about studying the book of Ruth and seeing where this woman actually comes from and where the people came from who make up the story. We're told in Ruth 1:5, getting back into the story, it says, Mahlon and Chilion died also, both of them, and the woman was left of her two sons and her husband. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the country of Moab how Yahweh had visited the people in giving them bread. Wherefore she went forth out of that place where she was, and her two daughters-in-law with her. And they went on their way to return unto the land of Judah. And Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, Go return each to her mother's house. Yahweh deal kindly with you, as you have dealt with the dead, and with me. Yahweh grant you that ye may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband. Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. And they said unto her, Surely we will return with thee unto thy people. And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters, why will you go with me? Are there yet any more sons in my womb, that they may be your husbands? Turn again, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say, I have hope, if I should have a husband also tonight, and should also bear sons tonight, she's saying, would you tarry for them till they were grown? So it's an interesting conversation that's going on here. Let me just read the rest of it, then we'll get into that. Would ye stay for them from having husbands? Nay, my daughters, for it grieves me much for your sake that the hand of Yahweh has gone out against me. And they lifted up their voices and wept again, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth cleaved unto her. So, what we have to understand is this is the next pivotal point in our story. And another discussion of the law of God has to take point here so that we can understand it better. And the discussion that needs to be had here is about what is commonly called the law of the leveret, which is what is being discussed right now. Okay, that's what we called it in our Western culture. It's called the law of the leveret. And the law of the leveret was commonly practiced. It was a common custom among the people of Europe as well, and in the Middle East, up until the time of Catholic power predominantly, as I've been able to find in historical reference. It was even after that that the practice was still common among more tribal and clannish peoples, particularly I was able to find among the Scots, the Welsh, and some Slavonic people. And this was even despite Catholic approval once the Catholic Church had its stronghold in those countries. So the Scots were well known for practicing this even during the time where polygamy was being discouraged by the Catholic Church and downright told not to happen, where a brother would marry his fallen brother's wife in order to have children with her after his death, of course, as to raise seed up to the clan. All right, and this was something that when people are more clan-minded, on account of the clans of Scotland, which most of us know about, and represented by tartans and such things like that, that it was very important for them to do this, to carry on the clan, to carry on the name of their father. So this is what's being discussed here in this part. This is the discussion where Naomi is trying to reason with these women and say, listen, I'm an older woman. Even if I were to get pregnant tonight and get a husband, there is no way that you're going to want to wait around for them to get old enough for you to marry, because the law in Israel, which I'm going to read in Deuteronomy chapter 25:5, if you want to start to turn there, the law in Israel is, this is the norm. This is the normal thing that was to happen in an Israelite culture. Okay, so these women were well aware, these women living in Moab, which I am going to just continue pushing the idea, that they are Benjamites who were aware of this law. In other words, if they were to marry the brothers of their husbands, Mahlon and Chilion, after they had come from the womb of Naomi, this would raise up seed to this family. All right, and this has to happen a specific way. And here is how. Deuteronomy 25:5, it says, if brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no children, the wife of the dead shall not marry without unto a stranger. Her husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn which she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother, which is dead, that his name be not put out of Israel. Okay, so that's the specific law that we are discussing right now whenever we go back and take a look at the things that are discussed between these girls. All right, they are willing to go along with their mother-in-law that they are bound to through marriage. And Naomi is relieving them of the obligation. She is telling them that, listen, when you made your marriage to my sons and you became part of our family, it would normally be required of you to do this, but because it's impractical, it's not going to happen, I give you leave to make your choice and leave. And she actually doesn't even give the choice of them staying if you consider the context of what's being talked about. So that's something that is important because it's showing, it's going to go ahead and it's going to show the character of Ruth over Orpah. Okay, Orpah is going to go back to her Gentile home, to her Moabite home, where her father and mother live among a strange people, where they are removed. Ruth, on the other hand, we are going to see, which has just been told to us, Ruth is going to follow along anyhow. She is going to do so despite the fact that Naomi is telling her, listen, there's nothing for you when you get there. I may never be able to find, you know, you a husband, you're never going to have a child out of my womb to marry, because Naomi would have to be the one who finds the kinsman redeemer, at least in the way that she's thinking about it. But what we're going to find is Ruth either understood this better or desired Yahweh's law more to become part of the people of Israel once again, and she clave to what maybe some of us would think of an archaic custom, a cultural norm of the Israelite people that was so intertwined with the kinsman redeemer law, with the family law, with the law that brings people back into the fold, that she was in love before she was in love with the man Boaz that we're going to read about. She was in love with Yahweh's law and the idea of being associated with Israel again. In other words, she is not going to be a removed person if she is able to cleave to Naomi. She's going to get to go back to Israel and be part of her people. And that's what I think is incredibly important in this study as we consider Ruth. Ruth 1:15, it says, And she said, "Behold," referring to Naomi, "thy sister-in-law is gone back to her people and unto her God. Return thou after thy sister-in-law." Now, you're going to notice I took away the plural word God, and there's a reason behind it, and I'm going to explain. The word God in Hebrew is the word Ela. Okay? Now, Elohim is the plural version of that, which can also refer to one God. However, in this specific section of this discussion, where I'm going to focus on next, it uses the word Ela, not the word Elohim. It's not the plural version. It's definitely a singular version. And I'll go to prove that here as we keep reading. Ruth 1:16, it says, "And Ruth said, Entreat me not to leave thee, or to return from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go, and where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God." Another interesting part here is the word God is Ela also. When he says, "thy God shall be my God," she uses the word Ela. She doesn't say, "thy gods shall be my gods," or anything like that. It is a singular version of the word. Ruth 1:17 says, "Where thou diest, I will die, and there will I be buried. Yahweh," and now she invokes the name of the Israelite Hebrew God, "Yahweh, do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." So she's just made a vow. This is a vow. This is vow language, and it shouldn't be looked at as anything less than that, or anything more for that matter. 18 says, "When she saw that she was steadfast-minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her." All right, so I'm going to focus on this LA word that I was talking about, the word for God. It's the same word used in 16 as used in 15, as a recap. But it is not necessarily the plural gods, which our King James Version uses for whatever reason. I've not been able to figure that out. But it is God singular. This can be seen in other words. There is no insinuation yet that Ruth and Orpah serve gods plural. That's why I'm bringing this up, because it's assumed by most that this is proof that she was a Moabite serving Chemosh and who knows who other gods of the Moabites. Chemosh specifically is one of the gods listed as being belonging to Moab. So it doesn't ever say that in the Hebrew. It's a singular version, so it's a god they're speaking of. And Naomi serves Yahweh, is what is generally supposed. Naomi's a Yahweh worshiper, worships the true God, but, you know, these girls are Moabites. So that's the normal interpretation. Both statements, however, are speaking of the same entity, Ela, or just the word God. This form is most commonly in the whole Bible. If you go and look through the Bible in a Hebrew copy of the Bible, which is pretty easy to do nowadays, thanks to people's hard work, when you will see the most common use of the word Ela used is when you read in your Bible, "the Lord God," or "Yahweh God." It actually says Yahweh Ela. In other words, the number one most commonly used word for God when it says Yahweh God is this word that we are reading. So by just thinking about that alone, there's no reason at this point to suppose that Ruth even worshipped another god, or that Orpah worshipped another god. All the statement is simply saying is that you go back and return to your family's ways, and I'm going my way back to the land of my people. And when she says back to her, she says, your God, your family's ways will be my family's ways. Okay, secondly, speaking of this, secondly, the second way this word alay is used is when you see the phrase in your King James Bible, strange God, or strange gods, sometimes plurally, but it should be translated strange God, or God of a specific people, such as the Philistines, or the Moabites, or whoever. It also is referencing idols. Now, the last time this word was used, talking about an idol, we would know clearly in Judges chapter 18, 24. Okay, specifically referring to the man Micah about the idols that he made personally. He personally made Elah, idols of God, a God idol, all right? Which we know he was using Levites to worship this God. So, in effect, this was some kind of idolatrous form of Yahweh worship. It was a worship of God through the use of idols, all right? Which, of course, is forbidden by God's law, but apparently that note was left behind as we have religions, Christian religions with us today, such as Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox and other Orthodox faiths who use images to worship Yahweh also. This is pretty much the same type of situation that we have with Micah. But in this case, when Micah refers to his God or gods in Judges 18:24, he says, "You have taken away my Elah, which I have made, my God." Okay, so there is another place where we can see that being referenced. And also, remember, strange gods can be Elah also. I'm not ruling that out and saying it's in absolute, but it is not. I don't think at that time that this conversation, a focal point that proves anything about Ruth's origins or where she comes from or if she's different. Thus, no matter if Ruth and Orpha served other gods prior or not, the phrase is part of the phrase of this is more important in the story. It's more important to consider the phrase that it is a covenantal binding between Ruth and Naomi. Okay, that's what's important here. It's not important which God she worshipped prior. What's important is that Ruth and Naomi are making a covenant. Ruth has covenanted with Naomi by saying, where you lodge, I'll lodge. Where you die, I'll die. Your gods are my gods. Your people are my people. Where you go, I'm going. When you die, I'm dying right beside you. Okay, this is a covenantal language. And so many people focus on this other god that that Ruth must have been a heathen. Rather than considering, we would do something very similar to this in pledging ourselves to other people even today. Okay? That she's pledging herself, for the record, to Naomi and her family. All right, she is entering into covenant with Naomi and saying, I am going to stick with you, and I want to be part of your family, whether you have children or you don't, whether you have a husband for me or you don't. So it's no different, I think, than what happens in adoptions, in biblical adoptions, if you consider it from that case, which I think is very important as we consider other verses in the Bible that talk about biblical adoption of that type. Now, when I say adoption, I don't mean she is assumed into the family and carries over the name of the family, at least not until a biblical adoption takes place according to the kinsman redemption, which is what we will get into by the end of this book. So I think that that's important to remember, that when Ruth agreed to a marriage with Mahlon or Chilion, I cannot remember at this time which husband she was married to specifically, but the one that she marries, when she married him, she married the family. That's how a biblical marriage works. You are marrying into a family. You are not marrying an individual. And that's kind of an important part of biblical marriage. So I believe the whole story of Ruth may be seen in the same words of the prophet Jeremiah. What he spoke towards the removed house of Judah. And I want to read that real quick just for reference sake. Jeremiah chapter 24, 6. And this is speaking to those of Judah who were removed into the land of Babylon. He says, "For I will set my eyes upon them for good, and I will bring them again to this land. And I will build them, and I will not pull them down. I will plant them, and I will not pluck them up. 7 goes on to say, and I will give them a heart to know me, that I am Yahweh, and they shall be my people, and I will be their God. For they shall return unto me with their whole heart. Okay, and that's the end of Jeremiah 24, 6 and 7. This heart is the heart of the matter, I think. This is the heart of Ruth that we're talking about. It's no different than Ruth, who I'm going to look at as Ruth the Benjamite of Moab, and how she was reconciled and is being reconciled unto her people, unto her God, whether or not she prior worshipped false gods like many of our Israelite ancestors did, okay, which is why they were carried away captive and why they were removed, is because they worshipped other gods. So whether her prior god was a bastardized form of Yahweh Eleh, or the Lord God, by idolatry or whatever, or whether she worshipped Chemosh, whether what everybody assumes is absolutely correct, whether she worshipped a Moabite god in a Moabite land, it was it really doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if she worshipped Yahweh by a strange law, in other words, ignoring the law of God but still used the word Yahweh or the Lord, or whether she was a full-blown server of pagan gods. It does not matter, because just as our ancestors of Judah and our ancestors of Israel were removed from out of the good land that God gave them, God went after them to make them his people and to make himself their God. Because if you go to the book of Hosea, you'll also read another situation of the Israelites who had been removed. And in Hosea 1:5 it says, it shall come to pass on that day that I will break the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel. And she conceived again, and she bare a daughter, and God said unto him, call her name Lo-Ruhamah, which means, I will have no mercy. And it says, for I will no more have mercy on the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away or remove them. But I will have mercy upon the house of Judah, he says, and I will save them by Yahweh their God. In Hosea, it goes on to say in 1:8, it says, now when she had weaned, no mercy, or Lo-Ruhamah, she conceived again, and God said, call his name Lo-Ami, which means not my people. For ye are not my people, and I will not be your God. And then in Hosea 1:10, it says this very powerful verse that's a reference to something Paul summarizes in Romans chapter 9, Paul the Benjamite, that is, where it says, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered, as it shall come to pass that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, there it shall be said to them, ye are the sons of the living God. And the children, then shall the children of Judah and the children of Israel be gathered together. And of course, this is referencing the time of Christ when this gathering is happening. However, don't miss the language that's being talked about. He is using the same language that we just read in Ruth, that your God shall be my God, and your people shall be my people. Okay, we are talking about something that is very similar in nature to both Jeremiah chapter 24 and Hosea chapter 1. It also goes on to say, in referencing the whoredom of the children of Israel, and how they went and worshiped Balaam, using the word Balaam. It then goes on to tell us in Hosea chapter 2, in the regathering of the children of Israel, it says, 2:17 of Hosea, I will take away the names of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And in that day will I make a covenant for them, and with the beasts of the field, and with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground. And I will break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth or the land. And I will make them to lie down safely. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. Yea, I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness, and in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercy. I will betroth thee unto me in faithfulness, and thou shalt know Yahweh. And it shall come to pass in that day that I will hear, saith Yahweh, and I will hear the heavens, and they shall hear the earth, and the earth shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil, and they shall hear Jezreel, referencing what we just read. Again, and then it follows up and ends by saying, in 23, I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy, and I will say to them which were not my people, Thou art my people, and they shall say, Thou art my God. So we can see very similarly both in the testament of the houses of Israel and Judah by Hosea and the house of Judah by Jeremiah, a very similar language. And I think it's very important as we consider these, rather than looking for these objections that a lot of times our so-called theologian brethren want to offer us about the discrepancies in Yahweh's law that God just decides to overlook and not care about, such as Deuteronomy chapter 23. Instead, we can see a very beautiful harmony, actually, specifically whenever we think about the prior chapter of Judges and the War of Benjamin that just took place. Benjamin was a rebellious, wicked people, a disgusting people, a people who fought for the freedom to live according to the way they wanted to so that their people can practice rape and homosexuality. I mean, that should be something that blows our mind, but I guess in our modern world, my words are probably going to sound dull compared to what they might have sounded like 30 years ago or 20 years ago. Because now it's becoming more common that we have an Israel like the Benjamites. But when we consider this section of the story, what we're seeing is a branch of the people, not just the remnant of those who are going to be redeemed out of the land of Benjamin, out of the inheritance of Benjamin, that were left, very few in number. But we're going to actually see also a remnant of the removed Benjamites that had lost their inheritance being brought back into the people of Israel by becoming God's people and God becoming their God. So in Ruth 1:19, we're going to finish up here, and it says, So they too, referring to Naomi and Ruth, went until they came to Bethlehem, the city of David. And it came to pass that when they were come to Bethlehem, that all the city was moved about them, and they said, Is this Naomi? Or is this the pleasant one? And she said unto them, Call me not Naomi, but Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. Now we can remember the bitter waters of Mara out of the book of Exodus and out of the law, where the history of Israel in the wilderness is talking. We should recognize the name Mara as being the same. And Naomi, of course, means pleasant, as I've been mentioning. So she's saying symbolically, do not call me pleasant, call me bitter, because God's dealt with me very bitterly since I saw all of you last. And she says in 21, I went out full, and Yahweh has brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me pleasant, seeing Yahweh has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me or made me bitter? So Naomi returned, and Ruth, the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. So we have the stage set for the time of the year. This would have been right after the Passover celebration, which always happens during green ears of barley. So we know Passover has passed, which I think if you symbolically pay attention to the book of Ruth, and I'm not suggesting it's not a real story. I believe it's 100% real. But like most stories in the Bible, God uses the people and the characters of the story to affect His will and to show something to us for our learning, as the Apostle Paul tells us that all the scriptures were written for us to learn from, that we are to use them for our good and for our learning. And so as we look back at this and we know that, for instance, Christ was our Passover lamb. And at the celebration of Passover, after that, Israel, under the new covenant, was allowed to enter back into the fold of God. And we're told that Ruth, this Moabitess, the Gentile Ruth, enters back into the land. But there's something interesting that it says here. It says something that most people read over and don't pay attention to. And that's what it says. It says this. I'm going to read it one more time and see if we catch it. So Naomi returned. Well, that's an obvious, right? Naomi was from Bethlehem, from Israel. And Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. So what I think's interesting is it says also that Ruth returned out of the land of Moab. Now, if she was a stranger to Israel, she was not an Israelite, if she had no connection to the land, she could not have returned to the land. In other words, she also was returning to the people of Israel. And she was returning, we're told, at the time of the barley harvest, which is important for the widows and the fatherless and the poor and those in Israel, because they were entitled to a portion of all the harvests of the land, if we remember in the law of God. It says that whenever you reap your field, or whenever you pick your olives or your grapes or your trees, that whatever's left over has to be for the poor, the fatherless, and the widow. Anyone who is afflicted and in need of more food, basically. And that's not to say that everybody who falls into that category needs to do that, or they had to do it in the time of Israel, but it was theirs. They were entitled to it. It was theirs by rights, we would call it. Okay, so it was a propitious time for these widows to enter into the land, so that they would not show up and be starved immediately. They would make the journey with no food, probably, or very little. And when they got to Bethlehem, which interestingly enough means the house of bread, Bethlehem, Lehem is the word for bread, specifically bread from grains, they would get there at the time of the harvest so that they could immediately start satiating their appetite with the gleanings of the field, which was their rights. Okay? And I think that that is going to conclude the book of Ruth this time, and we're going to jump back into chapter 2 at our next Sabbath Bible study coming up next new moon, and that'll be it.